and welcome to The Upgrade, a podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Jordan Calhoun, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Megan Walbert, Lifehacker's managing editor.
And this week, we're talking about a very large topic.
Yes, yeah, some might even say the biggest topic.
But not too big. I don't want to scare you off. Don't close your podcast app. We're going to be talking about how to talk to your kids about religion when you're not quite sure what to say. We're going to get into it with author Wendy Thomas Russell.
What I've learned is that it is really not what you say to them, especially when they're very young. It's not what you say to them about religion. It's how you say it. It's your tone. It's your tone of neutrality and just dispassion.
Wendy is a journalist turned author and publisher. She's the founder of the independent book publisher Brown Paper Press and is the author of Relax, It's Just God, How and Why to Talk to Your Kids About Religion When You Are Not Religious.
She's also the co-author of the award-winning Parent Shift, 10 Universal Truths That Will Change How You Raise Your Kids. And she also writes about parenting for the PBS NewsHour.
So Jordan, you've mentioned on the podcast before that your parents were pretty religious growing up. Can you tell me about that a little bit? What was your experience with religion like when you were a kid?
Oh, Megan, my childhood was full of religion. So I didn't have that type of experience where, you know, parents are told to let your kids decide for themselves or like learn their own beliefs. Like I think indoctrinated is probably a fair word.
Yeah.
I went to church several times a week. I still, to give you an idea, this is like one of my fun factoids when I try to convey just how religiously I was raised. I still know the names of all 66 books of the Bible in order. I think I still do.
Oh, go.
Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel, 1 Kings, 1 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi.
Jesus Christ. Oh, I should say that.
See, I would have clutched my pearls if I would have heard that as a child, taking the Lord's name in vain like that. But now I am an adult, and it's really interesting to see the outcomes of people who were raised the way that I was raised, and the outcomes of people like you who weren't raised super religiously, right? What was your experience?
Yeah, so I was sort of, half of my childhood was religious. So when I was growing up, we lived in an area where the public schools just weren't great. And so instead, we went to a Lutheran school, mm-hmm. which meant that in order to be allowed to be a student there, you obviously had to be baptized. You had to go to church every Sunday. You could only miss, I know this now, I didn't know this at the time, but you could only miss like, I think once a month or something, a church service. Like there was like a formula for like how religious you had to be. It was like very performative. And it wasn't until we moved to the suburbs when I was in fourth grade that just suddenly like we never went to church anymore. And I just thought it was because we were too far from the church and nobody felt like driving that far on a Sunday. But it wasn't until I was an adult and had this conversation with my parents that it was like, oh no, that was just, we just went to church because of the school. Like once we were out of there, we were out of there.
We got what we needed.
We got what we needed, and then we moved on.
That is so amazing. Well, I am looking forward to talking with Wendy and getting a good idea of how parents should have that conversation with their kids and some of the strategies that we can use when we're talking about religion.
Yeah, me too. This is going to be great.
Well, Wendy, thank you so much for joining us.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. So I want to start by saying how excited I am to talk about this subject. This is one of my favorite things to discuss because you get so many good personal anecdotes, I feel, from people who all have had the experience at some point of talking with their parents about God or having their parents, more often than not, or at least in my experience, having their parents, you know, start that conversation and instill their beliefs onto you. So by way of quick background, I was raised by deeply religious parents. Megan can add some more nuance to herself, but she was not raised by deeply religious parents. And I would love to hear your background and what got you wanting to write the book in the first place. So what was your experience like?
Well, my experience as a child was kind of religion light. It was I grew up in a really small town in Missouri. So it was, you know, one grocery store, one hardware store and like 16 Christian churches and no synagogues or temples of any other kind. So it was pretty impossible not to, you know, be a Christian on some level when I was a kid. But my parents were not overly religious. And I found out as an adult, well, I suppose I was in college, but that my dad was an atheist. He didn't believe in anything, but he never talked to me about that specifically as a kid. So, you know, I grew up around religion and then I kind of started losing it completely when I was in college and just started kind of thinking through some of the things like hell and, you know, meeting Jewish kids and thinking, does that make any sense for Jewish children to go to hell because they don't believe in Jesus? And so it started to kind of come apart. Like I lost hell at one point. I was like, okay, I don't believe in hell. Like that's off the table. It's just a no. That's a no.
That's the first to go.
That's the first to go. It's the first domino goes. And then I, you know, had to grapple with heaven. Like, well, wait a minute. These are like two sides of the same coin. If I don't believe in hell, then how can I believe in heaven? And so then I lost heaven too. And then after that, it just, you know, the dominoes kept falling. And then pretty soon I remember specifically going, you know, I don't believe in God. I don't think there's a God. And then waiting for something to happen that was bad, you know, waiting to be punished or something for that thought. And then everything just kept going on as normal. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. Like my life didn't change because I had that thought. And so, yeah, by the time I had my own child, I was in my 30s and had not thought about religion in a really long time. So it was really surprising to me and shouldn't have been, but it was when she came home from preschool one day and started telling me about how God made her and all the children, and that she was just incredulous as to why I wouldn't have mentioned this to her before, because this seemed like really good information.
It's the best stuff.
It's big stuff. It's so interesting. And so she was 4.5 or 5 at the time, and that's when I just like hit that wall of like, oh my God, I am so unprepared for this. I don't know what to say, because I really didn't want to indoctrinate her into my non-belief. And I didn't want to set her up to be teased or ostracized by, you know, religious peers. And I also, you know, didn't want to just leave her out, you know, hanging in the wind on her own. So I just had to figure out really fast how I was going to handle the situation, address the situation. And then when I did, I reached out to some friends and I just realized, oh my God, like I am really not alone in this. This is a huge issue. And not just for people that don't believe in religion, but people who are, you know, maybe just kind of moderate believers, or they are religious, but they're not really, they still don't know what to say to their kids. Maybe they don't want to indoctrinate them either. So it just became, well, it came really obvious that this was a subject that was going to be of interest to a lot of people.
How did you have that conversation with her then, especially because you were kind of caught off guard, as, you know, we often are with young children who seem to come across these big topics much sooner than, you know, we expect them to. How did you respond in the moment? And then did you go back later and say, because I know for me, a lot of times when I'm caught off guard, I might answer a certain way. And then I think, you know what, actually I need to go back.
I need a do-over.
So I'm curious whether that was your experience too.
Yes, it definitely was. My experience in the car that day was just that, just feeling like I was being hit in the head with, you know, a frying pan in the old cartoons. Like I was seeing stars. I just didn't know what to say. So I think I stumbled through that conversation. It was maybe 4 sentences long, and then came home and started kind of talking to my husband about how freaked out I was about this conversation. And after talking to him, he said something that really hit for me, and it was, it's not what Maxine believes, it's what she does in life that matters. And so at that point, it kind of reset, like, oh, right, she can believe whatever she wants. It's not for me to say these are the things you must believe and these are the things you must not believe. It was more, this is going to be a journey of knowledge. It's going to be a journey of giving you information for you to make up your own mind. And that was such a freeing thing. I have had a lot of do-overs, I will say, Megan. I have had a lot of do-overs because there have been times when she's asked something or I try to explain something and realize that I'm explaining this so dumb, or I don't even know the answers, or I'm trying to remember some religious story and I can't. And so I'll go back and do it over. And but what I've learned is that it is really not what you say to them, especially when they're very young. It's not what you say to them about religion. It's how you say it. It's your tone. It's your tone of neutrality and just dispassion to be able to talk about it openly and without, you know, some big baggage or something that just feels tight and tense. And like, this is a conversation I'm really, you know, I've been traumatized by this and I don't want to, you know, talk about it. And I'm showing that in all the ways that with my tone of voice and my body language. And I think that more it's just like, oh yeah, so let's talk about, you know, look at that symbol over there. Do you know what that is? Oh, that's the Star of David. And let me tell you about, you know, that's the symbol of a religion called Judaism. And talking about it that way, even when it gets a little hard, even when you're talking about things like heaven and hell and you know, some of the nuances of religion that can be a little bit more uncomfortable, still trying to create a tone of neutrality, it just speaks volumes. That's what they're going to remember more than any of the individual conversations that you barely made it through.
That's really interesting. When I think of, so a lot of the advice that seemingly exists out there around the topic is based on some of what you're describing and letting children decide their beliefs on their own, right? And I have a hard time wrapping my mind around that. And this is probably due to how I was raised myself, where I was given religious beliefs to believe in. But I have a hard time understanding how that process would look for children when they don't have the intellectual tools to really make those types of decisions. Like, by default, I would imagine most of their decision is going to be based on sort of how you described growing up, where, like, you know, there's 16 churches around you and everyone is Christian, so I guess I'm Christian too, right? Or if two parents have the same beliefs, then you're just going to believe what it is that they believe, even if they're not indoctrinating you with it. Is that normally the case? Am I thinking about this wrong?
Yeah, I know. You are absolutely accurate. I mean, most kids are going to adopt the belief system of the people around them. And that's why it is not, because that's the default, that's why as secular parents, it doesn't need to be so heavy with a threat. You know, I think that there's two camps of audiences that I really think need the most help. And one of them is the side that does not talk about religion at all with their kids because they want them to make up their minds and they don't even want to go there. They don't even want to say what they believe. And then there's the ones that are so freaked out by religion. Usually they've been traumatized by it that they can't imagine their kids getting into religion. And it's more like they think of it as like they will be taken into a cult or something if they believe anything supernatural. And so for the latter group, you know, it's kind of a comfort to know, listen, they're not going to join a cult. Okay. The chances are really, really low, especially if you are teaching them about the values of kindness and compassion and tolerance and diversity and open-mindedness. They're not going to join a cult. Like, that's, cults don't go in for that kind of thing. So if you're teaching them values, then you're kind of sending them on a path toward, you know, the good ethical moral life, and whatever the belief system around that they create is not going to be that big of a deal. But at the core of what your question is, yeah, they're probably going to walk in our footsteps. So why not arm them with the freedom of belief and of choice? Because even if they, I mean, you can argue too that if you do have, you know, a rebellious teenager, if you really, you know, are laying down the line that this is really important, that you believe exactly the way I do, you know, that's the perfect opportunity for some good old fashioned rebellion. So, mm-hmm. you know, but if you just leave it open ended and let them explore and figure it out for themselves and ask questions, then, you know, it's whatever they end up believing, it's not going to be super threatening to you.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
You know, kids have a very black and white way of looking at the world. You know, a thing either is or it isn't to them. And so this concept of belief, I think, can be confusing for them because, you know, with religion, it's not something that we can prove one way or another. So how do you talk? I believe you have a game mm-hmm. that you play.
I do, yes.
To help kids understand the concept of
belief. Yeah, so I think that a lot of parents get gummed up on this. Well, if I let them believe whatever they want, then they can believe that the world is flat and right. they can believe things that just are blatantly not true. And how do I allow that? And so the game kind of comes out of the very basic idea that kids can't really talk about religion until they understand what a belief is and why it's different from a fact and why it's different from a fiction. And so I created this little game that is called Fact, Fiction, or Belief, and I have played it many times with my daughter when she was much younger, and it's really a wonderful way to get them to feel the difference between the three things. And I don't use religious imagery when talking about the game or doing the game, but you introduce the idea of a fact as something that is true, and a fiction is something that is not true. And a belief is something that some people believe is true and other people believe that it's not true. So it's like an opinion in that way. And so then I would say something like the sky is blue, and she would say fact, and I would say right. And then I would say, and the ground is pink, and she would say fiction. And then I would say Brussels sprouts are delicious, and she would say belief. And so it doesn't have to be, it really was the point of it wasn't to be, you know, on the nose accurate as far as like, is the sky really blue? I mean, because it's really the atmosphere. You know what I mean? So like, we're not going there, but it's just, you know, it's a fun way of getting kids to know the difference. And when they can discern that difference, when they can discern the fact from the belief, that's when you really know you're safe to start talking about, to inject religious beliefs. And now they understand what a belief is, you know, and now just having that fundamental foundation can make you just feel freer to talk about things without being confusing. So Megan, I would say a second part of that would be that the idea that a fact is something that is not up for negotiation and may sometimes conflict with a belief is something that some people have to figure out for themselves. It's not something I have to figure out for them. You know, I can believe in the Big Bang and I don't have anything else that is conflicting with that. Some people, the fact is that there was a Big Bang and there was evolution. That is true. That is fact. And some people also believe that God made the world. And so they have to make those things go together. You know, they, or some people believe that humanity began with Adam and Eve. I don't have to make that make sense, but I don't have to make it not make sense either. It's not up to me to say, oh, well, see how stupid that is? Because we know evolution is true, so that's stupid. Like, no, we can just say, yeah, some people believe that. Some people believe this. This is a fact that we know to be true. So, you know, figure it out for yourself.
And when we're talking big picture, I think most of us would agree that institutionalized religion is one of the largest, if not the largest, sort of cultural, historical, influential force, in humanity. It's very, very important. And it's not taught well in schools, or is it? I guess my question here is, how much of the onus should be on parents to teach this thing? Like, if it's so important, is it taught adequately in schools? Or do parents need to take the onus on themselves to teach about various world religions and what different people believe?
Yeah, it's a great question. I was just thinking about it this morning as I was thinking about talking to you guys, because it would just be so ideal if, you know, we talk about taking the religion out of schools. It's not important to take the religion out of schools. It's important to take the one religion out of schools and put all the religions in schools in terms of education, you know, in terms of saying this is religion. Let's do a comparative or a world religion class for all elementary kids and show them.
Right. You can teach about it without proselytizing.
Exactly. Yeah. We're not going to have prayer in school because that's praying to a certain, you know, but it's one specific religion that, you know, and I'm not talking about Christianity. I'm talking about whatever religion is in that area in the world that is being brought into the school. That's the issue. It isn't bringing religion in. It's not, you know, I think we should be able to talk about religion in schools. It just needs to be on a more general religious literacy kind of level so that we understand, because you're so right. Like there's so much about society that is just engulfed in religion. It's all around us. It's in everything. It's in our buildings. It's in our literature. It's, you know, so many of the themes of our classic literature are religious symbolism. You know, it's such an important part of many of the lives of the people that we know and love that to ignore it just doesn't make any sense. And the second part of your question was, is it on the parents? I think it is. And I think it doesn't have to be a huge chore. I think some people hear religious literacy and they're like, eyes glaze over, and I totally get it. But it doesn't have to be that way. You can take the idea of, you know, oh, okay, here's a Jewish holiday coming up. Let me take the opportunity to say some things about Judaism. And maybe I'm going to look them up on Google or Wikipedia, and I'm going to get, you know, a few talking points, and I'm going to introduce them at the kitchen table, and that'll be enough. It doesn't have to be huge. But the bigger deal is to take advantage of the world around you and not to ignore the religion in the world around you. Because like we were talking about, it's everywhere. So we don't really need an excuse like a holiday necessarily to bring it up. We can just bring it up in all of the ways that we see it, but we don't share it.
You know, I'm wondering, because I feel like a lot of this conversation is, you know, non-religious people giving advice to other non-religious people. And so I'm wondering, you know, for somebody who is moderately or strongly religious, you know, how should they approach this as a parent? Is it, you know, because that's going to be pretty difficult to sort of not to do this fact fiction belief, because to me, my belief might actually be fact mm-hmm. in my mind, because that's, you know, I believe it so strongly. Yes. So what is your advice for the more religious parents and handling these topics with their kids?
It depends on how religious they are, because at some point, they don't need my advice. There's religious people that if they believe that their religion and their beliefs are fact, then they're going to teach their kids those facts. And they're not going to be looking at my book for ways to talk about that, because they know all the ways to talk about it. Religious people have been doing a very good job talking to their kids about religion for a very long time, their own religion. I think that if you're talking about people who are religious, but they're also very interested in their kids having a great foundation for all religions and understanding all religions, even though they're bringing their kids up in a certain faith, then you get into, it can still be, you know, it can still be helpful. The fact fiction game can still be helpful to a degree, but then they need to be really open about the fact that, you know, yes, this is a belief that a lot of people think is true and a lot of people think is untrue. I happen to think that it is true. I very strongly think it is a fact. You could do it that way, because then you're still at least letting them in on the idea that this is a belief, you know, and they're going to figure that out at some point. It's not like, you know, kids reach the age of 18 and don't figure that out. But it's kind of nice in those early days because it can be really confusing for children when they encounter other kids at school that don't believe what they believe. And it's very, I mean, my daughter is a great example because she ran into kids in her early elementary school years that were just incredulous. Like, what do you mean you don't, you know, you don't believe in God? How is that possible? It's like not believing in the teacher, you know, standing at the front of the right. class. It does not make any sense. So, and her, you know, her thing, just incidentally, because I think it's cute. She chose to believe in God 2 days a week when she was a kid. So she wanted a couple of days that she believed in God. And then she didn't believe it in the other days. And then, you know, she went through several like iterations of kind of believing, no, I think I do, you know, I talked to grandpa and I think that I do, I think the other grandpa, not my atheist dad, grandpa, but, other grandpa. And I, you know, I think I do believe in God. And so it was just, you know, she was just an exploration for her for a very long time. And I love that idea too, about giving kids the information that you're going to get, you do not have to make up your mind right now. You have a long time to figure it out. So you just try on different beliefs and believe whatever you want, because, you know, it's going to change and that's all good.
I'm curious, because this can be such a contentious topic, what kind of pushback did you get, if any, when the book came out and when you were, you know, speaking about these topics?
It was surprising to me how little pushback I got. I was thinking that I was going to get a lot of hate mail and, you know, a little bit of hate. But honestly, because the book is written in a way that is really about tolerance and about open-mindedness, it's not anti-religious in any way. And so what I have found is that even the religious people who have read the book for whatever reasons, I mean, I know like my mom chose it as her book club pick. That was really interesting because then like, there's all these like grandmas that are reading this book and would not have ever picked it up before. But they were all just, they all got a lot out of it. And because it was not, it wasn't insulting to them. There's nothing insulting about it. And in fact, it's, I think for some people, it's been refreshingly not insulting. They have this idea that if you are an atheist, it means you're anti-religious. And that is not the case. So I think it's not always the case, I should say, because of course it is for some people. And I also think that there is a lot to be gained for religious people in terms of here's some ideas about how to approach religion in a way that does promote tolerance. Because I think that most people in the world really do want their friends or their kids to get along with their friends and not to offend, you know, the kids who are different from them. And we all want our kids to get along with each other. And so there's a lot of that kind of information in the book that almost could be extrapolated, you know, for a lot of different reasons and ways.
The last question I have for you here, Wendy, as we wrap up is, how do you know when your kids are ready for this conversation? Do you wait for them to bring it up to you? Do you proactively bring it up to them as a parent? Like, where do you decide, you know, this is the time to start having this conversation about such a big thing?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that I have two answers because I don't think there's necessarily one perfect answer. One is you can wait for them to bring it up. In my experience, you should have an answer ready. So maybe you think about that beforehand. And then when they bring it up, you can say, great, I'm so glad you're bringing this up. You know, let's talk about it. You could do that. Or you could start as soon as they understand the difference between fact, fiction, and belief. And that's why it's such an interesting game to play at that, like maybe 4 years old, and they're sort of showing interest in things like, you know, supernaturalism and big topics like that, that are, I mean, I feel like generally it's going to be, you know, 4 to 5 years old is going to be kind of a prime time, but it could be a little bit earlier and it could be a little bit later. And I think you kind of gauge the kid and their sort of interest in it too. So that's why I don't know that there's a perfect answer, but I think around that age is really good. You don't want to wait too long, because I will tell you from experience that they stop listening to you. At about 12, you're not an influence on them anymore. They are just
my
like,
son's 11.
Oh, honey, it's coming.
Bad news.
I'm so sorry. But they really start to like turn to their peers, and they're not as interested in hearing you pontificate on certain things, if they ever were. And so I think, you know, definitely you've got like a really strong 6 years in there. So use it, you know, to your advantage, or you lose your influence entirely.
I've got 1 year left.
Use it wisely. Whitney, this was absolutely amazing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Now it's time for our upgrade of the week, where we talk about that one thing that's making a big difference in our lives. And Wendy, I'm going to start with you. What's your upgrade this week?
My upgrade is that I have been reading a lot of philosophy books. And So from a lot of the Stoics, but I just read Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, which I'd never read as a kid. I know a lot of people read that in school. I did not. And just digesting as much kind of philosophical wisdom as I can. And I've been combining it, putting it together into a book of my own, just for myself. It's not a book I'm publishing, but it's just to, as a reminder of what I know to be true, what helps me in almost any situation that I'm in. And it's almost like I'm creating a self-help book just for my brain. So really appreciating that. And I would highly recommend in some way for anyone to create something like that for themselves. I forget everything that I read almost immediately. So I need to write down like the bits that are important, but that's my upgrade is Stoic wisdom.
That is such a clever idea. And it reminds me as well, like of the things that I did read in school. And I guess I should preface this by saying I didn't read much in school. Like most of the things that were assigned to me in school, I didn't actually really read, but even if I did read those things, I wouldn't have understood them at the age that they were assigned. There's so much that I get now if I were to, you know, I read Lord of the Flies like as an adult. That was something that, of course, I was assigned in school. But like, one, I didn't read it. But two, even if I did read it, I didn't understand what was going on there.
I could not agree more. Yes.
Yeah. Agreed. Going back and reading or rereading those things that you were assigned back in school, clutch move. Very great. Megan, what about you? What's your upgrade this week?
All right. My upgrade this week is an app called Team Snap. So it's an app that it's used, I guess, primarily by sports teams, so like youth sports teams. The previous system prior to this fall that we had been using was just one never-ending group email thread, which just, I don't check my personal email that much. You know, notifications could come through, like a game is canceled or a practice is rescheduled, and I'm just not going to see it. So this app that finally our coach this year decided to use is really great. You can message on it. So we have a team message thread. We can just message directly with the coach, and then you can get notifications for team practices, games coming up, all the information. And it's all in one spot. And I actually do check it and I get notifications from it. So I know what is happening and where my child needs to be at any given moment.
Awesome. What's it called
again? It's the little things.
Awesome.
It's called Team Snap.
Team Snap. Man, there's an app for everything.
It's great. So if you're a parent, tell your coach about this app because it will make your life a little bit easier.
Love it.
Wonderful.
Jordan, what about you? What's your upgrade?
My upgrade this week is also based on an app, but it's an app that most people probably already know about and probably already have. We've probably talked about Libby before. Do either of you have Libby?
Yes, I love Libby.
Absolutely love Libby as well. And the upgrade, or at least something that I've started doing recently, is normally when I go on Libby and there's a book, you know, especially if it's a new book that's come out, I'll look at it on Libby, see what the audiobook or the digital book wait list is like. And if the wait list is long, I will not put it on hold because, like, I'm not waiting 36 weeks for Michelle Obama's book or whatever. Like, I'm just going to end up either buying it or finding some other way around it, right? But just recently, and I think I did it by accident, there was a book called The Midnight Library that I was going to read for my book club, and I ended up putting it on hold. I don't remember doing it. I must have done it sleepwalking. But the wait was supposed to be something ridiculously long, and then it just came through surprisingly quickly. Like, it was just sort of a Christmas gift one day where I got a Libby pop-up notification that said, like, your book is now available for download. You have it. And I was just like, oh, I should actually do this more often. So I started going through the most popular list on Libby and just putting everything on hold. There's a limit of the number of things you can put on hold. I think it's 5 or 6 things. But I would put bestsellers on hold, even if they had an eternal wait list, because sometimes it actually flies by significantly faster than what the wait list says. And then you just end up getting, you know, a surprise gift every now and then. It obviously costs you nothing to put it on hold. So you just end up getting a book that's available to you that you forgot that you would even put on hold. And it's a nice little pleasant surprise. And it'll happen so far, at least the few times that I've noticed, it's happened a lot faster than I expected. So my upgrade is putting things on hold on Libby, even if you think the wait list is too long, because it's probably not nearly as long as you think.
Yep,
I'm just trying to see how serious you are about it.
And I think actually probably a lot of us do that. And that's why it comes up so quickly, because we're all doing that. And then it's like, oh, shoot, I'm engaged in another book. And now that book's available. I can't get that right now. So then they give it back. And then it just keeps going down the line much faster. Because I've noticed the same thing. I do the same thing.
Yeah. Same type of logic of, like, you know, you're waiting in line at the theme park and, like, the line is the roller coaster is down for a little bit, and then everyone else leaves the line, and you're like, oh, maybe I'll just stay for 15 minutes longer to see
take my chances.
If King Dakar is going to come back online, and then suddenly you're at the front of the line. It happens really quick. Like, it's that exact same logic.
Okay, that was specific.
Applied to books. Yeah. It's not like I was at Six Flags recently with my nephew. I had this experience. This was completely hypothetical. Oh, man. Wendy, this was so much fun. Thank you again for joining.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you so much, Jordan. Thanks, Megan.
Thank you.
And that's our show. The Upgrade is produced by Michaela Heck and mixed by Brad Fisher.
Please rate us on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review so others can find and enjoy the show. You can also reach us by calling 347-687-8109 and leaving a voicemail, or write to us at upgrade@lifehacker.com.
You can also find Lifehacker on Twitter @Lifehacker, on Instagram @Lifehacker.com, that's all one word, and on Facebook @Facebook.com/Lifehacker. You can also find me on Twitter @JordanMCalhoun, Megan @MeganWalbert, and you can ask us about, you know, our childhoods and religion. We love answering those questions. And you can sign up for Lifehacker's daily newsletter full of tips and tricks and hacks @Lifehacker.com/newsletter. And of course, you can find show notes for this episode and every episode of The Upgrade by just going to lifehacker.com and searching for podcasts. See you next week.